and welcome to DNA Today. I'm your host, Kira Deneen. Today we're talking genetics, and we talk genetics every Monday at 11:30 a.m. You can hear me live on whus.org or on 91.7 FM, talking news stories, lessons, everything to keep you updated and educated on the ever-changing world of genetics. And UConn has so much genetic-related things happening, and there's lots of events, not only related to genetics, but the sciences, biology, chemistry, all kinds of stuff here at the store's campus. And I recently attended the infectious disease and microbiome events. If you'd like to attend these types of events, they're free to the public, and they really are a great insight into what researchers are doing, and they're presenting their work. And sometimes it's kind of more geared towards undergraduates and it's easier to understand, whereas other times it's a little bit more challenging and you get a few things out of it. But either way, it's really great to be exposed to these different things. And it's exciting just to hear what research is going on and what advances we're making. And what always gets me is at the end when people are asking questions and saying, have you done research on this and that? And when the researcher says, you know, we don't know yet. We don't know what's out there. We don't understand this yet. And that's exciting to me because we don't really have a great grasp on things yet, certain types of fields and everything. So it's really cool to hear what we're currently doing, what we don't know about, and just where we're headed with how we're finding that information out. So you can follow DNA Podcast on Twitter to stay updated on all these events. I tweet about them pretty much as soon as I know, and then usually when the event's about to start to remind everybody. So that's at DNA Podcast on Twitter. So the next event is April 21st at 7 p.m., and that would be tomorrow. So it's a speaking event with Ann Diamond, the CEO at John Dempsey Hospital at UConn Health Center. And this is a speaking event sponsored by the Connecticut Association of Healthcare Executives. It's taking place, again, April 21st from 7 to 8 in Laurel 201 here at the UConn Stores campus. And it's a unique opportunity for those interested in public health, medicine, or business to learn more about this field and about UConn Health Center, which is located right in Farmington, Connecticut, little under an hour from here in Stores campus. And you, Ann Diamond has been with the UConn Health Center in this role since 2010, and we encourage all interested students to attend. And if you want more information about it, because that's about all that's available right now, but if you want more information, you can contact Leadership in Action at UConnLIA@gmail.com. Again, that's UConnLIA@gmail.com. And, you know, show up, see what it's like. Again, it's geared towards people interested in public health, medicine, business. And this is an interesting aspect that, you know, a lot of people know about, oh, research, becoming a doctor and everything. But there are so many different roles and careers within healthcare that a lot of students aren't aware of, or even the general public aren't aware of. So it's really great to be exposed to these different roles and everything just to see what's out there. That's kind of what I like getting out of these events is you show up and you get something out of it and you never know what it's going to be. You might meet someone, you might learn a couple new things, or even learn about a new field that maybe you may pursue. So always worth going. And it's a good location, Laurel, center of campus. So I mentioned that I went to two other events. I'll be going to this tomorrow, so I'll be talking about this probably the next episode. But there were two other events kind of related to genetics and healthcare. That I want to talk about. The first one was plugging away at leaks in the public health dike, the infectious disease. And they talked about infectious diseases, especially Ebola. So I'm really going to focus on Ebola because they talked about that for a while. Now, this event was sponsored by the UConn student chapter of the American Society for Microbiology. And Kathy Feldman seems to be the front runner of this. And she brought in two speakers for this. And so it was really interesting to hear from them. They're very passionate about what they do, which always makes these types of events more interesting. And you really get a vibe from them that they love what they do. And then you're going to be more into it. So the first speaker was Dr. Richard Melkwright, and he's the Healthcare Associated Infections Program Coordinator at the CT Department of Public Health. And he discussed a host of infectious diseases, challenges facing public health today. And he discussed concerns and pandemic influenza, outbreaks for foodborne disease, healthcare-associated infections, and antimicrobial-resistant pathogens. He talked about MRSA, drug-resistant TB, and CRE. So he talked about quite a bit, and the presentation went about an hour and a half, so I'm going to cover a couple highlights from it. The other presenter was Dr. Randall Nelson, and he is from the CT State Public Health, and he's a veterinarian there. And he expanded upon a lot of what Dr. Melkwright talked about. So we'll kind of just get into a few things now. So one thing that they talked about was a zoonotic disease. And first I was like, what is this? But it's actually something that you probably already know about. You just don't know that this term is applied to it. So it's a disease that can be passed between animals and humans. So believe it or not, this is like 6 out of every 10 infectious diseases scientists estimate that more than 6 out of every 10 infectious diseases are actually spread to humans by animals. And they can be caused by viruses, bacteria, parasites, and fungi. So quite an array of different things, that it's not just one. That that's kind of why it's 6 out of every 10, because it has these 4 main pathways of passing on from animal to human. We're talking about viruses, bacteria, parasites, and fungi. And because of interactions with animals, it's important to be aware of the different ways people can get zoonotic diseases. And so he talked about 3 main types. And one is coming in contact with saliva, blood, urine, or feces of an infected animal. And when we're talking about animals here, we're not just talking about wild animals. You can also get it from your pets, dogs, cats. And so this is something to be aware of. Second one he was talking about is being bitten by a tick or mosquito, often called a vector, because they're kind of a vector for the disease and carrying it to you and delivering it to you. So that's why it's called a vector. But definitely good in the summer to wear all of that tick repellent and all that good stuff. Third was eating or drinking something unsafe, such as unpasteurized milk, undercooked meat, or unwashed fruits and vegetables that are contaminated with feces from an infected animal. So those were the 3 main types, so good to be aware of. He talked a lot about the Ebola virus transmission, and there are viruses that are in the blood, body fluids, and stool of symptomatic patients, and that's kind of how Ebola is being transferred. And this is human to human transmission, which is different from what I was just talking about, of talking about zoonotic diseases being animal to human. With Ebola, we're talking about human to human, but also dog to human transmission can happen. But dogs are carriers. They don't get sick from it. They're kind of just passing along to you. It's not really going to affect them. They're just a carrier. So that's why we're really focusing on the human-to-human transmission, because even though dogs can give it to humans, they're not being affected. So methods of transmission. So we're talking about direct contact, broken skin or unprotected mucous membrane with infected patients, blood or body fluid. So really it's that exchange with direct contact, sharps injuries, direct contact with a corpse, and indirect with contained objects like bandages. So right now there are about 200 CDC employees in West Africa, and one of their responsibilities is to quarantine people that are affected by the disease to protect others from being infected, because we're talking about them being infected by either people that have it and are patients, or corpses that are still carriers of the disease. Now, healthcare providers are interacting with people that may or may not be infected. They don't always know, okay, could this person be infected? And you always want to treat the case as if they are infected and take those precautionary measures. So what do healthcare providers wear to protect themselves from getting this disease? They wear what they called a moon suit, which is kind of interesting, but it reminded me of if you've seen E.T., when everyone is really, you know, in those huge suits that are completely covered, kind of like that. And they also wrap corpses when they bury them to prevent the virus from passing along. So they really try and contain it that way. So how does Ebola work? We've heard about this. We've heard it in the news. But really, how does it work? Well, it has an incubation period of 2 to 21 days. And this is the time between catching the infection and then the symptoms appearing. And the symptoms can include sudden fever, chills, muscle aches, nausea, vomiting, chest pain, sore throat, quite an array of things. And the fatality rate is about 60%, which is a scary number. It's very high. It's not super high, but it's still up there. And the fatality rate can be reduced by getting more fluids in the patients, because they're losing so many fluids that they really need to replenish this. And that fatality rate can plummet if the right treatments are given. So where is Ebola prevalent right now? Well, it exploded in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia in West Africa. And Senegal had 1 imported case. Nigeria had 20 cases and 8 deaths. And both countries are not considered Ebola-free. It may not be really in the news right now, but it definitely is something that is still happening. And it's also spread to other areas in the world. England had 2 cases that were airlifted. Spain had 2 cases airlifted. 1 had died. And the U.S., we had 2 imported cases. And they entered before diagnosis, and one died from it. Two were locally transmitted, and a handful of healthcare workers were airlifted, and one died. So it definitely was spreading, but the CDC really does have a better handle on it now, and having all kinds of precautionary measures to avoid this. So once in the U.S., then U.S. citizens started to care, as usually what happens is when disease starts affecting the U.S., then people are like, oh, this is a big deal now. We really need to combat this. And now it's a focus to educate people about Ebola in the countries that are affected. And if Ebola was as prevalent as it was in other countries, it would be very fearful. If just imagine if in the U.S. we had 25,000 people dying of this, we would be very fearful. We'd be doing more about it. We'd be educating more. So definitely that's something that is impacting how much we are educating people, how much we're even educating doctors and everything of how to handle these situations. Now, as I mentioned before, the CDC, among other organizations, are working very hard to prevent further spread. But how do they do this? So it's actually interesting. I had no idea that how they are involved with airports. I figured, you know, that's the way that it's kind of transmitted. But they really are having surveillance activities. So Governor Malloy had a press release on October 27th, 2014, outlining the state's policies for monitoring, not quarantining, but monitoring, that's important, travelers from Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. And five airports have instituted screening of all persons arriving from the three countries of interest. So state and local health department responsible for keeping track of them. And these people had to have their temperature monitored for fever for 21 days before they could fly. And they didn't find anyone with Ebola. And so that was positive. But it's very expensive to do this, to monitor people before they're able to fly. And it's effective, but it's very expensive. And some people argue that there are better areas in healthcare to spend money on than this. But they monitored 75 people in Connecticut, and this was for 21 days, again, to monitor their temperature to see if they had a fever. And once they had a fever, or if they did, then they would kind of intervene on that and hospitalize. And this only happened to one person that went to the hospital, and this kid was in New Haven, and he came back from Africa, and he was treated as a potential Ebola patient, but he did not have it. But they had everything in place to be able to prevent this. So it was a great presentation, awesome information, and just a good look at public health and just kind of how we are able to prevent the spread of disease. So definitely interesting. The next one was Dynamics of the Human Microbiome. And this was a presentation by Rob Knight from the Pediatrics and Computer Science and Engineering of the University of California. And he presented on the dynamics of the human microbiome. And microbiome is something I've talked about a lot at one of the Jackson conferences that I attended back in October. The microbiome was talked about a lot. I want to say at least half of the presentations were really focused on advances in the microbiome, learning more about the microbiome, and saying it's kind of the next project after the Human Genome Project that now the microbiome is kind of being focused on. So I want to share a few points he made during his presentations that shows just how powerful the microbiome is in all of us. And it's outstanding to me to grasp that 10 trillion human cells, that's how many we have, but we carry 100 trillion microbial cells. So you're not even mostly human, which is kind of weird to think about, but you are actually mostly microbial cells. You are microbes. And each of us have about 20,000 human genes, but we have 2 to 10 million microbial genes. So compare that 20,000 human genes to 2 to 10 million microbial genes. And it's interesting how much of our microbiome varies. It's not like, oh, everybody, like our genetics, we have 99.9% of genetics you share with the person next to you. Now, you may only share 10% of your microbiome because there's so many environmental influences on your microbiome compared to genetics. Genetics, you're born with the genes you have. Epigenetics is a little bit different. We'll get into that in a future episode. But your microbiome is really shaped by your environment. And where our microbes come from really depends heavily on how you're born. So if you were born via a cesarean section or vaginally, that has a huge impact on how your microbiome is. And it was interesting to hear in the summer, you know, we get bitten by mosquitoes, some people more than others. My brother always gets attacked. And I'm like, ah, get a few, whatever. And it's interesting to hear that differences in the microbiome changes the attractiveness of us to mosquitoes tenfold, which is crazy that it can be that different because of your microbiome. So, you know, if you're someone that is really affected by mosquitoes, that might be why. And there's a lot of diversity in the microbiome, as I've talked about, but does all this diversity matter? And it turns out it really does, because the microbiome has been linked to various diseases. And we're trying to figure out what diseases are related to the microbiome. And we have identified a few, but we're looking at how many more unknown microbiome-related diseases can be treated or even cured by microbiome medicines. And so this is really kind of a new frontier for us to be able to look at the microbiome and say, how can this affect treatment? How can this affect maybe curing people, diagnosing, all of that stuff that we're able to do through the microbiome? And the microbiome can also tell if you're obese. It has a 90% accuracy rate that if you have microbiome testing done, that the researcher or person running the test can tell without looking at you, without, you know, no information other than your microbiome, 90% accuracy if you are obese. And that's compared to 60% accuracy with genetic analysis. So quite a differentiation between these of 90% accuracy with microbiome and 60% accuracy with genetic analysis. Now, a few kind of microbes that can survive harsh cleaning of hospitals are the ones that may affect us and that really could have a strong impact on us because they're so resistant to antibiotics. They're so resistant to antiseptics and disinfection techniques and materials that these are the kind of cream of the crop microbes that are kind of the strongest, if you want to phrase it that way, that they're super resistant. And these are ones that people in hospitals can sometimes get. So that's kind of relating to the microbiome just because your microbiome is made of these microbes. And when you introduce different microbes to it, it can really change things. And one of the future kind of potentials of microbial of the microbe that Rob Knight mentioned was that we could have a our microbiome profile in our health records, similar to people comparing it to having our genetic profile or our genetic sequence available in our health records, that it's possible that our microbiome may be available in health records down the road, and that this could be great indication that maybe that researchers and doctors too, both ends, doctors more personally helping people, researchers looking at grand picture and looking at new methods, treatments, cures for diseases, but that doctors can look at this and say, all right, this is what your microbiome is telling me, this is what your genetics is indicating, how can I use this knowledge to then better treat you, better serve you? And it's interesting that the diversity of the microbiome increases with age. So As when we're very young, our microbiome is similar to others. But as we're growing older and getting different experiences, different exposures, it really does differ. And this kind of reminds me of epigenetics, the regulation of our genes and gene expression, because epigenetics is talking about the different environmental factors that affect how your genes are regulated. And this is the same thing. The microbiome is regulated by a lot of our environmental our environmental influences. So it's very interesting to hear how it progresses with age, same as epigenetics. And I've been working on a show that really gets into the epigenetics of twins. And it's really interesting to hear that with twins, their epigenetics, at birth, it's very, very similar. But as they have different experiences throughout life, it's very different. So their gene expression, they have the same genes because they're identical twins, but their gene expression is actually different because they've grown up and had different experiences. So if you compare twins at the age of 3 and twins at the age of 53, their epigenetics or epigenome is going to be much different. And the genes that are turned on and off are going to be very different compared to, it's going to be very different in the 53-year-old than in the 3-year-old. So really cool to hear how age really does impact, and that whole nature versus nurture debate, where it's not really versus, but more hand in hand of the relationship between nature and nurture. And that's really what epigenetics is about. So I'm excited to talk about that in a later episode, but thought it was worth mentioning with age. And the microbiome has a huge industry. 1.1 million is reported in the cost of kits that have been sent out for people to analyze their microbiome. 9,000 kits and over 4,500 samples have been sequenced and data in the EBI, and more is needed. This is really kind of a new front, and more samples are needed to be able to learn more and figure out how things are related and all of that. And it really boggles my mind how much the microbiome can reveal about someone. It can even reveal whether you exercise inside or outside. So if you run a treadmill versus running outside, your microbiome can actually detect this. And even how much you sleep. If you're someone that gets their 10 hours a night versus gets 4 hours a night, your microbiome reflects this. And as I've said before, testing is huge, and being able to diagnose and sequence information from your microbiome. And during the Q&A session, Rob Knight kind of joking, but could actually happen, which is kind of cool, that maybe in the future stool samples would be collected from one's toilet and then could be sent quick analysis, and then the results could be sent to your phone so you could monitor your microbiome, because this is really the main way of monitoring it, through fecal samples. And fecal transplants are the treatment and medicine that is coming out of the kind of field of microbiome and looking at that and researching it. And Rob Knight brought up that this is something that kind of the public and consumers have to have an acceptance of, and they kind of have to get over the fact that they will be ingesting, if they go through this treatment, that they'll be ingesting fecal matter. And this could take a while to get used to. It eventually may become as common as antibiotics, but there's different methods of doing this, and it's kind of something that can skeeve some people out, but definitely it's a huge field that really there's a lot of advances being made, and it's exciting to see how fast things are evolving in this. But lots of great information, and I want to remind you of the presentation, the next big presentation at UConn here related to healthcare, is April 21st at 7 p.m. It's a speaking event with Ann Diamond, and she's the CEO at John Dempsey Hospital at UConn Health Center right in Farmington, a little under an hour from the Storrs campus here. But she's coming to the Storrs campus, and the event is sponsored by Connecticut Association of Healthcare Executives, and it's taking place April 21st from 7 to 8 p.m. in Laurel 201. And it's really a great opportunity for people interested in public health, business, and medicine to learn more about different experiences that are available in the health field and different careers. There's all kinds of things that a lot of people are not aware of on the administrative side, more on the medical side, somewhere in between, lots of different things available. So Anne quite has the experience. She has been with UConn Health Center since 2010, and it's great for all students to attend. If you want more information on this event, you can contact UConnLIA@gmail.com. They can answer your questions, but basically 7 p.m. Laurel 201. And it's going to be great. I'm going to be there. Excited to hear from Ann Diamond and just learn more about even UConn Health Center right in Farmington, because that's where Jackson Laboratories is. And it's a beautiful place. And it's really cool to learn more about what's happening there. And you can follow DNA Podcast on Twitter to stay updated with everything happening related to genetics, or sometimes just related to healthcare. You can follow on there at DNA Podcast on Twitter. Also, website is great to check out, dnapodcast.com. I have lots of information on there that really gets into genetics and ethics and healthcare and all kinds of great stuff, research that's happening. Usually it touches on genetics somewhat, but sometimes I like to branch out a little bit. So you can tune in next week, Monday at 11:30 a.m. on whus.org or 91.7 FM to learn more about genetics. And if you're interested, you can also follow me on Twitter at Kira Dineen, KiraDineen. And I want to remind everyone before I close out that I love receiving emails, info@dnapodcast.com. I love hearing from you listeners. And if you have a career or something that's related to genetics, even a personal history. You had your genome sequenced, or you are going through something that you have a genetic disease, you have a rare disease. I'd love to hear from you. I really do like doing that. That's one of the reasons I love doing the show, is because I really like reaching out to people that are kind of exposing themselves to information in the field of genetics. So you can send in any questions you have, you want me to answer. I can look into them, see how qualified I am, but I can look into it. info@dnapodcast.com. And I want to thank you guys for listening to this episode of DNA Today on WHUS.org.